in the village or region IRA. Therefore, the attractiveness of corporate raids would be lessened because who wants to buy the right to receive rental? The only thing that, or the major asset that the native corporations would retain. What the corporate raiders would want would be the management of the oil, for example, on in subsurface rights, or the management of the timber for surface rights. They would not want to receive just like an investment in a bank and receive interest.
Ocean beauty.
Yeah, yeah. They would want to control ocean beauty. But supposing ocean beauty, the canneries that ocean beauty has, were in the management of the Central Council. See?
Sure, go ahead.
Yes. You mean that other corporations use corporate money to finance their political gains? Are they embezzle money without being prosecuted? They can do that? Or they don't have to let the stockholders know or get financial statements or things like that? They don't have to do that? Other corporations don't? You mean to tell me that Chrysler Corporation, he can take money from their corporation and use it for his political gains? I don't think so.
Well,
all I want to know is why these people that are robbing us aren't getting prosecuted. I know people that have embezzled money and they just, you know, and it goes up into the thousands. And why we can't get financial statements. And nobody's going to tell me that my land has to go into a national park or whatever, because it don't work like that. I just want to know is why the law is not protecting us. That's all I want to know.
The very nature of a corporation is that the business of the corporation is run by directors. General Motors or Pacific Telintel, when it wants to sell a building, does not go to the shareholders to get permission to sell the building.
If they embezzle money or some of that sort, they will be prosecuted, right? But if you own a stock, you get to know what that stock's worth. Well, I know it's not worth nothing now, like till after, like 1991. But what financial statements? You cannot get that information.
Well, I mentioned at some length a while ago that the Alaska Native Corporations are exempted from the rules of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and I discussed that at length. I think you had stepped out of the room, but maybe Mr. Paul could. Let me also add this, that if someone has embezzled something, that's a crime. And the law enforcement authorities in Juneau, that's their responsibility. The law enforcement authorities in Washington, if it comes within federal jurisdiction. And if you have evidence of that, you should go to the law enforcement authorities.
Oh, you know, I mean...
Well, you know, I...
If they won't even let us know how much money we have in our corporation or whatever, you know, to me it's... they're breaking laws.
Well, do you have any comment on all this, Mr. Paul?
Well, it's true that the 1976 Act exempted the Native corporations from the SEC's laws. But the state of Alaska has a portion of the federal laws adopted as a state law, the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934. And that act, the 1934 Act, gives shareholders immense power in the sense that management or a dealer or a broker, somebody connected with a stock transaction, you have to tell the truth. And if you don't tell the truth, then you're violating the 1934 Act, and the officers directly can be sued. For example, lately there was a big to-do over at Kodiak. Kodiak had a merger going on with the village, some village corporations. Some of the shareholders in the village corporation sued to set aside the merger. And because the federal act was exempted, they used the state act, the state equivalent of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and prevailed. There is a tool available, but it takes somebody with a lot of do-re-mi to invoke that law, hire lawyers, and it's very, very expensive. Two Seattle law firms, in defending that case, each charged more than $1 million in the merger case out of Kodiak.
I thought there was a surplus of lawyers in this country. They charge that much money?
Well, I'm a lawyer, and I believe in lawyers.
I do, too. Some of them just get paid a little too much.
Anyway, there is a solution. The trouble is, most of us are on the breadline, and we can't invoke it because of lack of money.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Redding.
Mr. Paul, you had there was something said about General Motors or whatever. I want to tell you here, when we had our shareholders meeting, I had resolutions passed. One of them was this, okay? Now you listen. It was passed. There are to be no further sales of EAC Corporation land without specific approval by the majority stockholder vote at an annual or special meeting, except for the sale of land in the existing subdivision projects or where sales must occur to live up to existing corporate commitments. I had an attorney look at this too, by the way, three of them. Mm-hmm. Two, EAC Corporation and its subsidiaries are not to commence any new business ventures without specific approval by the majority stockholder vote following presentation of a detailed feasibility study and a market analysis at an annual or special meeting. Number three, EAC Corporation shareholders should request an audit by the federal government. Thank you.
May I say one more thing? As far as the land claims doing any good, for our young, the majority of the young people, it hasn't done any good. I wouldn't want 50% of the catch or anything like that, but I'd like to see it where a native can fish if they want to. Especially from a village of like 90 people there or something, they can't go fish in Bristol Bay unless they go spend $200,000 for a permit. And to me, it don't make sense, and they got land claims. What good is land claims? Your children are suffering. I'll never suffer. I'm not worried about that, but there is a lot of Native suffering because of this land claims, and it's a joke. A few people get, right back where I started, they get like $80,000 a year, and then they have another job, and they're not qualified to begin with. You know, it don't make sense. No, I'm not happy with the land claims. I think it was a joke. A joke, a big joke.
Yes, sir. Just a comment on what Mr. Raddick said. We've been to villages in the southeast, Chugach and the Aleutians, Bristol Bay, and the point you make about limited entry has come up again and again. And it's occurred to me too. These people are no longer entitled to fish, so. Why are we having all this argument about land claims? They've already lost a great deal.
Maybe we haven't lost. There's a few things, like I don't think maybe they're not holding up to everything. If we could look through the fine print, I'm sure the government's in violation somewhere.
Yeah. There's a gentleman over here who wanted to say a word. Is that...
I was trying to ask a question.
Oh. You go ask your question.
Mr. Paul, I have a friend who has brought up the question on the fish, which is a very intriguing question, and I'd like to voice it. And that is that this is a land settlement, and it addresses only land. And the mistake the natives are making is accepting the decision of the state of Alaska as to the right of there to fish. Now, the Washington State Indians have won the case of the fact that they are allowed to fish in their usual and habitual places. The state of Alaska and the federal government have not addressed the fact of native fishing rights, and it has not been at all extinguished. And the problem here, again, is what you said in the beginning, is the fact of legal fees and to fight it.
The problem of defining the Settlement Act as a Land Claim Settlement Act runs into one of the sections of the Settlement Act, namely that all Aboriginal rights are extinguished. All means all. I would like to say something about limited entry. I think that's a very vicious law, and you're looking at somebody who fought it through the courts, only to lose it. Now, one of the reasons why I lost the Ostrowski case is I didn't have enough money to finance it. You got to have anthropologists, you got to have fish scientists, you got to have economists, and it's still not too late to attack the limited entry system. The Alaska Supreme Court upheld the law, but there is still a companion case which could be brought in the federal court under the federal constitution now that the state issues have been settled under the 14th Amendment, equal protection, some fundamental rights that are involved, but without a war chest of the best part of $500,000, it cannot be won. It should be won. It's a vicious law. We can go through village after village and see people who know nothing but fishing who cannot fish, and that's wrong.
Well, thank you, Mr. Paul.
Good morning. My name is Bobby Vinson, and I used to work for Ocean Beauty Seafoods, and I was a manager at a location in Sandpoint, Alaska. I managed Sandpoint's buying station for 5 years, and after New England Fish Company, I managed it for New England Fish Company, and after New England Fish Company went out of business, then Ocean Beauty, they came in and they leased the property from the NEFCO's bankrupt trustee, and I managed it for them. But the reason, a friend invited me this morning, and I thought I'd like to come and at least say a few things. In 1980, NEFCO's operation, or NEFCO Ocean Beauty's operation at Sand Point.
NEFCO is New England Fish.
Yeah, that's New England Fish Company, NEFCO. New England had just gone out of business in 1980, and so Ocean Beauty came in and they started leasing the facility, and they hired me as their manager because I managed it previously. And the operation became somewhat a little bit different because the peninsula area was having just some outstanding fish runs for the past couple years, and so there was a lot of fishermen from the Bellingham area. They were moving. Well, they were coming up to Sand Point to fish. Some of the fishermen in the Sand Point area, they started complaining that some of the Bellingham-based fishermen were receiving more money for their catch, and so they started asking me about it, and so I started asking questions. I let two managers, one at Kodiak King Crab, he ran the operation there, and also another manager at Uganic Cannery, I let them know about it, that the fishermen were complaining Well, an explanation to that was that they sent me, one of the managers sent me this little cartoon about this little bird that was chirping, and he got ate by a cat. In other words, I was getting into some area that I shouldn't get into. And so I owed it to the fishermen up at Sand Point, because there's not too many locations that have black managers. Let's face it, there's just not. And I owed it to the fishermen in the Sand Point area to watch out for their interests, because they had been good to me. When we first started out at Sand Point, we only had like seven boats, NEFCO's operation, because some of the fishermen just, they were not used to seeing a black manager. But after a few years, they started trusting us, and we jumped from 10 boats in 2 years to 30, and I think it was 1978, we only had 10% of the pack on the peninsula, but in 1979 we caught 30% of the pack, which the pack I'm talking about was NEFCO Peter Pan, and that amounted to 100,000 cases. In fact, that year, Sand Point's location turned out to be the best location for NEFCO. So we came up with 100,000 cases, and then we estimated that the next year we'd end up catching between 40% and 45% of the pack. So that was very substantial, considering the fact that we were building a fleet. We didn't really have it, but then people started trusting us and seeing that we were approaching them with honesty and fairness, and then they started coming over to the fish for New England's operation. So I thought it was totally unfair for the fishermen of Sand Point, so I started questioning the policy in 1980. In 1981, I started writing memos, because the fishermen said, well, we're not going to fish for you. Why should we fish for you if you're going to pay the people, the guys from Bellingham, more money than the fishermen than the Aleut native fishermen in the Sand Point area? And so it was hard maintaining a fleet, because they didn't want to believe in that. And management, they were aware, because I sent them memos, and I talked to them directly. But then again, like I said, they wanted me to keep my mouth shut. I wrote a report in October of 1981, and they let me go in October 20th of 1981. They decided they didn't want that location. I think they decided they had a person there that was not going to totally play ball with them. And it wasn't from the fact that I wasn't trying not to play ball with anyone. It was just from the fact that I was trying to run an operation with fairness. So when I started complaining, I do want to say that I don't like to say anything unless I have a fact to back it up, because I can make several statements about how things went and some of the things that I saw, a lot of wasted money, but some of those things, it would take an auditor to go through, or a good accountant just to point those things out. But it was a fact on the the native fishermen from the Sand Point area were getting less money. It was a fact. And I had evidence to back it up. And then when they let me go, I decided I wasn't going to take it. I was going to sue them. And so I took them to court. Well, I didn't exactly take them to court. I ended up settling out of court. But the fact still remains is that native fishermen in the Sand Point area were getting less for their catch, and Ocean Beauty Seafoods, they were aware of it. Their top management was aware of it. And like I said, I started in the seafood industry in 1971, and I ended my career in the seafood industry in 1981, because after you start talking a little bit, you're kind of blacklisted. And so I was blacklisted from the industry, and so that was it for me. But
may I ask you a question?
Sure.
You think then that maybe somebody was paid under the table above you? Do you think that?
Well, I really don't know if that's I don't know if that was a fact, but
native corporations through business deals, people are under the table deals go on. I've seen it myself.
Well, like I said, I like to have some facts, you know, like something of a factual nature. If I made that type of statement, but there was incidents that some of the uses of the boats that were owned by Ocean Beauty were it was a clear waste of money. I couldn't understand it, but I was not in a position. I was in middle management. I was not in a position to question it because I was in middle management. And hey, I'm a person in middle management. You can go quickly for questioning policy.
And so, you did.
Yeah, I did. I did. But anyway, I just wanted to make that statement. I probably had some other statements to make, but like I said, I like to make statements that are factual some statements, I think you need a really good auditor to go through and check over some of your books, and then I think you'll find out that some of the things that I'm saying are facts. And I also just wanted to say that in my time with the industry and with Ocean Beauty Sea Alaska, is that one thing that when you start talking about 1991, one really good thing is getting your young kids to start getting into management, because they're not there. And that's part of the problem. Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Vincent, thank you. Yes, Mr. Matthews. Could you come to the mic, Mr. Matthews?
Could you tell us, Mr. Vinson, if Sea Alaska lost when they gave up the plant at Sandpoint, and by production each year or in money?
Well, I'll just read you some statistics. In 1978, 10% of the total pack on the peninsula went to NEFCO's operation. In 1979, NEFCO's fleet caught 30% of the pack, which was 100,000 cases. And then in 1980, it was suspected that they'd have between 40 and 45% of the case pack. So that figure alone, those figures alone would tell you that there was a steadily buildup, but that if Ocean Beauty really wanted that location, if they really wanted to be a part of it, then they would have tried to base a fleet on the fishermen in that Sandpoint area, and they didn't do that. Their fleet was primarily based on individuals that were leasing licenses. I wrote a statement here, and I wrote a statement. If you don't mind, I'll read it to you. During the 5 years I've been a part of the operation at Sandpoint, the most sensitive issue was the non-native outside fishermen and their impact on the local traditional fishing areas. For our operation, it became a bit uncomfortable with the contention that our company paid non-native Bellingham-based fleet more money for their catches than native fishermen. No issue is more sensitive and more of an impediment to the success of Ocean Beauty's operation than the native fishermen versus the non-native fishermen. This issue should be handled with utmost care and concern. In my opinion, we should actively seek the Sandpoint fishermen as the foundation for a solid peninsula fleet. We cannot base an operation on fishermen who are leasing licenses. We should immediately combine the groups into one. If we do not, we are creating problems for ourselves down the road. in terms of dollars, I'm sure that you have to look at that. Sand Point would have been an outstanding operation, but then the company basically, I don't think they showed that that they really didn't want it. But I'm pretty sure they lost money on it because of the large runs that were happening on the peninsula.
Good. And there were two boats, I think you're aware of, that were up there, the Karen Z and the Colonel Korn, and the boats were financed by Kodiak King Crab. And was the money used wisely on them boats, or was it a waste?
Well, you see, like I said, I'm going to make a statement. This is a statement. But you have to go through and get the facts to back up a statement. But in my opinion, it was a waste. Well, I mean, it was a waste, and especially on the Karen Z. I couldn't understand some of the money that was being used on this Karen Z because of the history that it had over the past couple years because of the people that were running it. And so, in my opinion, that was a waste. And I think that all you need is an auditor. He can go through and he'll tell you that very factual.
And did you think that the management of Kodiak King Crab or Uganic was working for the good of the company or for self-gain?
Well, that's a difficult question because I think it was both. I think that sometimes it worked for the good of the company because that's the company that they represented, but then sometimes they were looking out for. It was just like, you know, corporate. It seemed to me that they looked at it like. It was a waste of the money to the corporation. That's what it was a waste of the money to. Some of them were wasting money to the corporation, I mean, itself, to the Sea Alaska Corporation, because it was money available that they didn't have before. And in other words, when they might have been with another, when Sea Alaska, I think at one time it was just Kodiak King Crab, not Sea Alaska, but Kodiak King Crab was just Kodiak King Crab, and I'm pretty sure they probably had some more restraints on the use of money, and then more money available tends to make people use money more, and so I think they were using money more that they could have been saving.
They got from Kodiak King Crab to use on them boats then was not owned by stockholders of Sea Alaska or any other corporation, was it? It was private boats from people other than stockholders of these corporations.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Well, look, I wonder if this would be... thank you, Mr.
Thank
Vincent.
You.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Oh, right. Could you give us your name, please?
Yes, my name is Darlene Cuvion. We share one thing in common, and that's color. And I have a question that relates to your culture that I find a correlation with our culture. First, I'd like to ask you if you're familiar with the Dred Scott decision.
Yes.
Okay, preceding the Dred Scott decision, the colored people, the Negro, the plantation owner, he interbred, and somewhere in there he bequeathed a legacy on the amalgamated child, this legacy being $1,000, of which was not to be paid to the child until that child was 21 years of age, 21 years too late. Now, I guess I brought that up because it's so similar to our present situation, going back 200 years in time, or whatever, 1857, I believe, that this legacy was 21 years. How many of the Negro people ever received, that you know of, their portion of that legacy?
That's a really interesting point because it's something that still is talked about today, and that's we never received any of it. I mean, none of it at all. It was always said that it was 40 acres and a mule, and that was the value at that in those days. But that was never received. I appreciate you saying though that we do have that common bond.
Well, thank you, Mr. Vincent. I think this would be a good time to take a break for lunch, and after lunch, maybe some of the folks who haven't had a chance to speak, we could let them go first, and then carry on with our discussion. So let's come back at let's say 1:45, and we'll carry on this afternoon. And thanks to all of you who spoke this morning. Well, folks, maybe we should get underway again, and if you'd like to take a seat, you're welcome to do so. We've had 50 people participate so far yesterday and today, 50 people who've testified, and I appreciate it. I perhaps need only say at this point that this commission was not set up by the federal government or the government of Alaska. It was set up by two international Native peoples organizations, the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People. And I'll be writing a report based on what you've told me. And that report will go to those two organizations and to the United Nations. But my report will be made public in September, and I'll be sending copies to all of the corporations and all of the tribal governments and to each one of you who has testified here today. And you'll get that in September. In addition, there is a transcript being kept of everything that you say. Jim Sykes, who's here with me, and Joyce Johnson, who's seated with him, are working with the commission, and they are keeping a tape of everything that is said, and there will be a transcript made. Indeed, you can order the transcript, if you wish, from our office in Anchorage, and Joyce has cards with our address on them that you can get from her if you want a transcript of what was said during these 2 days. The commission has been traveling for a year. We've been to 60 villages in Alaska, and more than 1,400 Alaska Natives have testified at those hearings in Alaska, and we've learned a lot about the land claim settlement. There are a lot of complaints about it. Most people in Alaska are very unhappy about it. They think that it may result in the loss of their land. They thought it was a settlement. They thought they got 44 million acres and that was that. It turns out that if the corporations go broke, they could lose their land. If their corporations are taken over by outside corporations after 1991, they could lose their land. In the 1990s, a state tax on their land could lead to the loss of the land through default of payment of taxes. They're concerned because the children born after 1971 are not entitled to be enrolled as shareholders. If their parents die, they may get shares, but a lot of Alaska Natives feel the children should get shares without having to wait until their parents die. People in Alaska are also concerned about shares. Some of them feel they should have the right to sell their shares after 1991 and get some money for them. Others say no, because the land, the 44 million acres, is held by the corporations. It's a corporate asset. And if too many Native people sell their shares after 1991 and outsiders buy up those shares, they will control the corporations. They will control the land. So that's a dilemma people have to face. Do they want to sell their shares and get some money after 1991? Or do they feel that those shares should stay in Native hands so that the Native corporations will remain Native corporations and the Native land remain in Native ownership? So those are some of the questions that people are concerned about. We've had a good hearing here in Seattle yesterday and today, and we've heard from 50 people. This is the last afternoon we have, and I thought that we might give some of those folks here now who haven't had a chance to speak an opportunity to do so. If any of you would like to, feel free to come up to this chair at this mic and let us have your thoughts. I should say that I appreciate that many people are unhappy about the fact that the corporations, many of them, haven't done well. There have been only a limited number of jobs available to Native people. There has been very little in the way of dividends or benefits. I'm aware of that. I'm concerned now not so much about all the things that went wrong, because I've heard about all that went wrong all over the state of Alaska and here in Seattle. But what do you think now? What ought to happen now? What's the best way to get out of this mess? So if anybody would like to, who hasn't spoken, would like to say a few words, you're welcome. Did any of the folks over here, you're the farthest from the witness chair, and... Yeah, okay.
Please. This is one of my main concerns on the stock transfer, because, see, this has happened, some of the people have died in my corporation and never left a will, okay? And it kind of bothers me, because as grandchildren, like I said, you know, it's not left to them, and I feel that if there's errors, you know, like grandchildren, it should go to them. On stock transfer under the ANSCA, upon the death of any stockholder, ownership of such stock shall be transferred in accordance with his last will and testament or under the applicable laws of intestacy, except that A, during the 20-year period after date of enactment of this act, such stock shall carry voting rights only if the holder thereof through inheritance also is a Native, and B, in the event the deceased stockholder fails to dispose of his stock by will and has no heirs under applicable laws of intestacy, such stock shall, and he to the regional corporation. And what I don't know if some of you people are aware of this or not, but there has been some people that have died that I know of, you know, in our corporation and have never left a will. So you people should be aware of this, that you should have a will made out or whatever, because it goes back to the corporation. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mott.
Hello. My name is David Austin. I was born and raised in Alaska. Ever since I was a kid, I think one of the most heard statements was, my grandchildren will never see any of this. And I believe that is so true now, because of the way that corporations are handling our assets and our monies. I also believe that we were sold out. I don't think we were allowed full due process of law. There's 77,000 people registered under the ANSCA Act, but I really don't know how many people voted to approve of, I don't know that part of the act. And what we have is, we've had 378 years of the white man living on this continent. Since they've come here, they've acted as a bad house guest. They were invited to stay here and to live with us and eat, but now they've taken over the household. And the assimilation is probably, into being white is probably the biggest program they have going right now, cultural genocide, physical genocide through abortions and things like that of Native peoples. Our alcoholism right now is helping to destroy our people. I've been to one end of Alaska to another, from Point Barrow to Bristol Bay, Cordova, wherever have you, interior, Wrangell Mountains. I trapped up there a few years ago. And the same percentage of people that are benefiting under the land claims, the people that are working in the offices right now, our presidents, people on the board, are about the same percentage as you'll find in Caucasian societies. Maybe 4% of the whole people are benefiting from it, and it isn't trickling down to the rest of us. And 1991, which is only 6 years away, it's going to be a sad day in Alaska. They've they sold out our land. I won't say our revered leaders did it. I don't know who did it. But if we don't get up and say anything about it now, and in 1991, then we won't be able to say anything. We need to be, there's such a infighting amongst our own peoples to where we are being defeated. Everybody wants to be chief. We need some cohesiveness, some camaraderie, and some of the old things that helped keep our people strong through tough times. I believe we need to have an answer to how, I do you know how this, who voted to sell our land?
Well, it's really Congress. They passed a law, and the president signed it. It's the folks in Congress who passed the law. And before the president, President Nixon, signed it, there was a meeting in Anchorage of people from all over the state, and they all voted for it, with the exception of Arctic Slope Native Association.
Mm-hmm. Smart people.
But I think they voted for it because they felt, well, this is the best we can do. And that's,
well,
at the time, they felt
point.
That
I believe
was the
that
best
through
thing.
Through the things that they've seen happen from the time the white man has come here, that was the only alternative they had. I mean, they've killed Native peoples starting from the East Coast over to the West Coast for 378 years. So what, how could we expect to get anything better out of them? Their track record is terrible. I mean, they've told 3,000 lies to us. Now they told us we're going to get 42 million acres and $1 billion. It sounded real good back in 71. It really sounded like we were going to be getting some land and that some respect
and
was
finally. And it sounded good to those folks who voted for it.
Yeah, it sounded good to them. And that's probably only 4% of the people voted on it that really knew what was going on.
Well, you see, in the villages in Alaska, people say, we didn't know about this. There was no referendum vote in the villages. But Congress was really saying, we want to get this passed so we can build this Trans-Alaska pipeline to bring the oil out of Prudhoe Bay, and you folks better decide whether you're going to get on board, because if you don't go along with this, maybe you won't get anything out of it. So you can see the dilemma people felt they were in.
Well, Well, I just feel that it was, yeah, it was their arms were being twisted at the time. It was the only way they had to go. And I believe we were got ill advised by attorneys that they were the ones that were making money out of land claims. I remember in the testimony back in Ketchikan back in May that we've become a welfare agency for attorneys. They've made hundreds of millions of dollars off of Alaska. And
Are you from Ketchikan?
No, I was born in the village in Sitka. I'm from the Shark House of Angoon, Wishkiton. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that the attorneys fully advise us that that was our land, that is our land, and that it wasn't to be sold. It shouldn't have been sold. I'm not sure about the context of this letter, but in the front page issue of October 1979 of Tundra Times, they had a letter to the effect written by, I guess it was equivalent to Secretary of State of Russia at the time, stating that they were not selling Alaska because they couldn't sell Alaska. They didn't own it. They hadn't defeated the whole peoples. What the American government was doing was buying stolen property. They were buying it from people who'd come over there, and like I testified back in May, they slaughtered the people up there. So in effect, in legal effect, the United States government is guilty of murder after the fact and of possessing stolen property after the fact. And I believe we better do something about it before 1991. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Austin.